whistleblowers, or even work as a lobbyist or public relations expert. These jobs are indicative of necessary failure in other things. Further, to be free of conflict, you need to have no friends, which is why Cleon was said to have renounced all of his friendships during his office. So far we have seen that the link between the individual and the collective is too fuzzy to interpret naively, so let us consider the classical situation of the terrorist who thinks he is immune to harm. How to put skin in the game of suicide bombers. Can someone punish a family for the crimes of an individual? The scriptures are self-contradictory. You can get both answers from the Old Testament. Exodus and Numbers show God as visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third or fourth generation. Deuteronomy makes a separation. Fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers. Each one shall be put to death for his own sin. Even today, the question isn't fully settled, nor is the answer clear-cut. You are not responsible for the debts of your parents, but German taxpayers are still responsible for war reparations for crimes committed by their grandparents and great-grandparents. And even in ancient times, when debt was a burden that crossed generations, the answer wasn't clear-cut. There was a balancing mechanism of periodic, literal, cleaning of the slate, with jubilee debt forgiveness. However, the answer is clear in the case of terrorism. The rule should be, you kill my family with supposed impunity, I will make yours pay some indirect price for it. Indirect responsibility isn't part of the standard crime and punishment methodology of a civilized society, but confronting terrorists who threaten innocence isn't standard either. For we have rarely in history faced a situation in which the perpetrator of a crime has a completely asymmetric payoff and upside from death itself. The current narrative is that terrorists think they are going to heaven and will meet virgins that look like their next-door neighbors. Not quite true. Many just seek a perceived heroic death or to impress their friends. The desire to be a hero can be quite blinding. Hammurabi's code actually makes such a provision, transferring liability across generations. For on that same basalt stele surrounded by Korean selfie sticks is written the following. If the architect built a house and the house subsequently collapses, killing the firstborn son of the master, the firstborn son of the architect shall be put to death. The individual, as we understand it today, did not exist as a standalone unit. The family did. Gypsies have rules that remained for a long time opaque to outsiders. It was probably not until the movie Vengo, 2000, that the general public discovered a dark custom among Gitano tribes. In a case where a member of one family kills a member of another, a direct relative of the killer will be delivered to the family of the victim. The unusual nuisance with jihadi terrorism is that we are totally defenseless in front of a deluded person willing to kill scores of innocents without any true downside, that is, no skin in the game. In northern Phoenicia, Alawis are terrorized by Salafis wearing bomb-filled jackets that they can activate in a public place. There is almost no way they can be caught without activation. Killing them on sight leads to false positives, but we can't afford false negatives. As a result, we have instances of private citizens cornering and hugging perceived self-bombers in places where detonation would be least harmful. This is a form of counter-suicide bombing. Explicit communal punishment can be used where other methods of justice have failed, provided they are not based on an emotional reaction, but on a well-outlined method of justice defined prior to the event, so that it becomes a deterrent. One who is sacrificing himself for a perceived upside for a given collective needs a deterrent, so it is a form of injection of skin in the game where there are no other methods, and the skin is visible, that very collective. The only way we have left to control suicide terrorists would be precisely to convince them that blowing themselves up is not the worst-case scenario for them, nor the end scenario at all. Making their families and loved ones bear a financial burden, just as Germans still pay for war crimes, would immediately add consequences to their actions. The penalty needs to be properly calibrated to be a true disincentive, without imparting any sense of heroism or martyrdom to the families in question. But I feel queasy about transferring a crime from one unit, an individual, to another, a collective. What I do not feel bad about is preventing the family of the perpetrators of terrorist acts from benefiting from those acts. Many terrorist groups reward the families of suicide bombers, and this can be safely terminated without any ethical dilemma. Next. In the last two chapters, we examined the good and the bad of dependence and the constraints on our freedoms coming from skin in the game. Next, let us look at the thrills of the right type of risk-taking. Book 5. Being alive means taking certain risks. Chapter 5. Life in the Simulation Machine. How to dress while reading Borges and Proust. There are many ways to convince with an ice pick. Councils of bickering bishops. Theosis. Why Trump will win. He actually did win. I once sat in a dinner party at a large round table across from a courteous fellow called David. The host was a physicist, Edgar C., in his New York club, a literary sort of club, where, except for David, almost everyone was dressed like people who either read Borges and Proust, wanted to be known as readers of Borges and Proust, or just liked to spend time with people who read Borges and Proust. Corduroy, ascot, suede shoes, or just business suit. As for David, he was dressed like someone who didn't know that people who read Borges and Proust needed to dress in a certain way when they congregated. At some point during the dinner, David unexpectedly pulled out an ice pick and made it go through his hand. I had no clue what the fellow did for a living, nor was I aware that Edgar was into magic as a side hobby. It turned out that the David in question was a magician, his name is David Blaine, and that he was very famous. I knew very little about magicians, assumed it was all about optical illusions, the central inverse problem we mentioned in Prologue 2 that makes it easier to engineer than reverse engineer. But something struck me at the end of the party. David was standing by the coat check using a handkerchief to sop up drops of blood coming out of his hand. So the fellow was really making an ice pick go through his hand, with all the risks that entailed. He suddenly became another person in my eyes. He was now real. He took risks. He had skin in the game. I met him again a few months later, and, as I tried to shake hands with him, noticed a scar where the ice pick had come out of his hand. Jesus was a risk-taker. This allowed me to finally figure out this business of the Trinity. The Christian religion, throughout Chalcedon, Nicaea, and other ecumenical councils and various synods of argumentative bishops, kept insisting on the dual nature of Jesus Christ. It would be theologically simpler if God were God and Jesus were man, just like another prophet, the way Islam views him, or the way Judaism views Abraham. But no, he had to be both man and God. The duality is so central it kept coming back through all manner of refinement, whether the duality allowed sharing the same substance, orthodoxy, the same will, monothelites, the same nature, monophysites. The Trinity is what caused other monotheists to see traces of polytheism in Christianity, and caused many Christians who fell into the hands of the Islamic State to be beheaded. So it appears that the church founders really wanted Christ to have skin in the game. He did actually suffer on the cross, sacrifice himself, and experience death. He was a risk-taker. More crucially to our story, he sacrificed himself for the sake of others. A God stripped of humanity cannot have skin in the game in such a manner, cannot really suffer, or if he does, such a redefinition of a God injected with a human nature would back up our argument. A God who didn't really suffer on the cross would be like a magician who performed an illusion, not someone who actually bled after sliding an ice pick between his carpal bones. The Orthodox Church goes further, making the human side flow upward rather than downward. The 4th century Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria wrote, "Jesus Christ was incarnate so we could be made God, emphasis mine." It is the very human character of Jesus that can allow us mortals to access God and merge with him, become part of him, in order to partake of the divine. That fusion is called theosis. The human nature of Christ makes the divine possible for all of us. The Son of God shares our nature so we can share his. As he has us in him, so we have him in us. Chrysostom. Pascal's wager. This argument, that real life is risk-taking, reveals the theological weakness of Pascal's wager, which stipulates that believing in the Creator has a positive payoff in case he truly exists, and no downside in case he doesn't. Hence, the wager would be to believe in God as a free option. But there are no free options. If you follow the idea to its logical end, you can see that it proposes religion without skin in the game, making it a purely academic and sterile activity. But what applies to Jesus should also apply to other believers. We will see that, traditionally, there is no religion without some skin in the game. The Matrix. Philosophers, unlike the equally argumentative but vastly more sophisticated and more colorfully dressed bishops, don't get the point with their experience machine thought experiment. The procedure is as follows. Simply, you sit in an apparatus and a technician plugs a few cables into your brain, after which you undergo an experience. You feel exactly as if an event took place, except that it all happened in virtual reality. It was all mental. Alas, such an experience will never be in the same category as the real. Only an academic philosopher who never took risk can believe such nonsense. Why? Because, to repeat, life is sacrifice and risk-taking, and nothing that doesn't entail some moderate amount of the former, under the constraint of satisfying the latter, is close to what we can call life. If you do not undertake a risk of real harm, reparable or even potentially irreparable, from an adventure, it is not an adventure. Our argument that the real requires peril can lead to niceties about the mind-body problem, but don't tell your local philosopher. Now, one may argue, once inside the machine, you may believe that you have skin in the game and experience the pains and consequences as if you were living the actual harm. But this is once inside, not outside, and there is no risk of irreversible harm, things that linger and make time flow in one direction, not the other. The reason a dream is not reality is that when you suddenly wake up from falling from a Chinese skyscraper, life continues, and there is no absorbing barrier, the mathematical name for that irreversible state that we will discuss at length in Chapter 19, along with ergodicity, the most powerful concept I know. Next, let us consider the signaling benefits of overt flaws. The Donald. I have a tendency to watch television with the sound off. When I saw Donald Trump in the Republican primary standing next to other candidates, I became certain he was going to win that stage of the process, no matter what he said or did. Actually, it was because he had visible deficiencies. Why? Because he was real. And the public, composed of people who usually take risks, not the lifeless non-risk-taking analysts we will present in the next chapter, would vote any time for someone who actually bled after putting an ice pick in his hand, rather than someone who did not. Arguments that Trump was a failed entrepreneur, even if true, actually prop up this argument. You'd even rather have a failed real person than a successful one, as blemishes, scars, and character flaws increase the distance between a human and a ghost. I note that even the fact that Trump expressed himself in an unconventional manner was a signal that he never had a boss before, no supervisor to convince, impress, or seek approval from. People who have been employed are more careful in their choice of words. Scars signal skin in the game, and people can detect the difference between front and back office operators. Next. Before we end, take some Fat Tony wisdom. Always do more than you talk, and precede talk with action, for it will always remain that action without talk supersedes talk without action. Otherwise, you will resemble the person we expose in the next chapter, which hopefully will offend many intellectuals, the insidious disease of modern times, back office people, that is, support staff, acting as front office ones, business generators. Chapter 6. The Intellectual Yet Idiot. People who don't have skin in the game. Lipid phobias. Teach a professor how to deadlift. What we saw worldwide from 2014 to 2018, from India to the UK to the US, was a rebellion against the inner circle of no-skin-in-the-game policy-making clerks and journalists' insiders, that class of paternalistic, semi-intellectual experts with some Ivy League, Oxford, Cambridge, or similar label-driven education who are telling the rest of us, one, what to do, two, what to eat, three, how to speak, four, how to think, and five, whom to vote for. Where to find a coconut. But the problem is the one-eyed following the blind. These self-described members of the intelligentsia can't find a coconut on Coconut Island, meaning they aren't intelligent enough to define intelligence, hence fall into circularities. Their main skill is a capacity to pass exams written by people like them, or to write papers read by people like them. Some of us, not Fat Tony, have been blind to their serial incompetence. With psychology studies replicating less than 40% of the time, dietary advice reversing after 30 years of dietary fat phobia, macroeconomics and financial economics, while trapped in an intricate gargantuan patch of words, scientifically worse than astrology, this is what the reader of the Inserto has known since Fooled by Randomness, the reappointment of Bernanke in 2010, who was less than clueless about financial risk as the Federal Reserve boss, and pharmaceutical trials replicating at best only a third of the time. People are perfectly entitled to rely on their own ancestral instincts and to listen to their grandmothers or to Montaigne and such filtered classical knowledge, who have a better track record than these policy-making goons. Science and scientism. Indeed, one can see that these academico-bureaucrats who feel entitled to run our lives aren't even rigorous, whether in medical statistics or policy-making. They can't tell science from scientism. In fact, in their eyes, scientism looks more scientific than real science. For instance, it is trivial to show the following. Much of what the Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler types, those who want to nudge us into some behavior, much of what they would classify as rational or irrational, or some such categories indicating deviation from a desired or prescribed protocol, comes from their misunderstanding of probability theory and cosmetic use of first-order models. They are also prone to mistake the ensemble for the linear aggregation of its components. That is, they think that our understanding of single individuals allows us to understand crowds and markets, or that our understanding of ants allows us to understand ant colonies. The intellectual yet idiot, IYI, is a product of modernity, hence has been proliferating since at least the mid-20th century, to reach a local supremum today, to the point that we have experienced a takeover by people without skin in the game. In most countries, the government's role is between 5 and 10 times what it was a century ago, expressed in percentage of gross domestic product. The IYI seems ubiquitous in our lives, but is still a small minority and is rarely seen outside specialized outlets, think tanks, the media, and university social science departments. Most people have proper jobs, and there are not many openings for the IYI, which explains how they could be so influential in spite of their low numbers. The IYI pathologizes others for doing things he doesn't understand without ever realizing it is his understanding that may be limited. He thinks people should act according to their best interests, and he knows their interests, particularly if they are rednecks or from the English non-crisp vowel class who voted for Brexit. When plebeians do something that makes sense to themselves, but not to him, the IYI uses the term uneducated. What we generally call participation in the political process, he calls by two distinct designations, democracy, when it fits the IYI, and populism, when plebeians dare to vote in a way that contradicts IYI preferences. While rich people believe in one tax dollar, one vote, more humanistic ones in one man, one vote, Monsanto in one lobbyist, one vote, the IYI believes in one Ivy League degree, one vote, with some equivalence for foreign elite schools and PhDs, as these are needed in the club. They are what Nietzsche called Bildungsphilisters, educated Philistines. Beware the slightly erudite who thinks he is an erudite, as well as the barber who decides to perform brain surgery. The IYI also fails to naturally detect sophistry. intellectual yet Philistine. The IYI subscribes to The New Yorker, a journal designed so Philistines can learn to fake a conversation about evolution, neuro-something, cognitive biases, and quantum mechanics. He never curses on social media. He speaks of equality of races and economic equality, but never goes out drinking with a minority cab driver. Again, no real skin in the game. As I will repeat until I am hoarse, the concept is fundamentally foreign to the IYI. The modern IYI has attended more than one TED Talk in person or watched more than two TED Talks on YouTube. Not only did he vote for Hillary Monsanto Malmaison because she seemed electable or some such circular reasoning, but he holds that anyone who didn't do so is mentally ill. The IYI mistakes the Near East, ancient Eastern Mediterranean, for the Middle East. The IYI has a copy of the first hardback edition of The Black Swan on his shelf, but mistakes absence of evidence for evidence of absence. He believes that GMOs are science, that their technology is in the same risk class as conventional breeding. Typically, the IYI get first-order logic right, but not second-order or higher effects, making him totally incompetent in complex domains. The IYI has been wrong, historically, about Stalinism, Maoism, GMOs, Iraq, Libya, Syria, lobotomies, urban planning, low-carbohydrate diets, gym machines, behaviorism, trans fats, Freudianism, portfolio theory, linear regression, HFCS, high-fructose corn syrup, Gaussianism, Salafism, dynamic stochastic equilibrium modeling, housing projects, marathon running, selfish genes, election forecasting models, Bernie Madoff pre-blow-up, and p-values. But he is still convinced that his current position is right. Pareto's comments are harsher than mine on this topic. Never gotten drunk with Russians. The IYI joins a club to get travel privileges. If he is a social scientist, he uses statistics without knowing how they are derived, like Steven Pinker and psychalofasters in general. When in the United Kingdom, he goes to literary festivals and eats cucumber sandwiches, taking small bites at a time. He drinks red wine with steak, never white. He used to believe that dietary fat was harmful and has now completely reversed himself. Information in both cases is derived from the same source. He takes statins because his doctor told him to do so. He fails to understand ergodicity, and when explained to him, he forgets about it soon after. He doesn't use Yiddish words even when talking business. He studies grammar before speaking a language. He has a cousin who worked with someone who knows the Queen. He has never read Frederick Dahr, Libanius Antiochus, Michael Oakeshott, John Gray, Ammianus Marcellinus, Ibn Battuta, Sadia Gaon, or Joseph de Maistre. He has never gotten drunk with Russians. He never drinks to the point where he starts breaking glasses, or preferably chairs. He doesn't even know the difference between Hecate and Hecuba, which in Brooklynese is can't tell crap from crapanola. He doesn't know that there is no difference between pseudo-intellectual and intellectual in the absence of skin in the game. He has mentioned quantum mechanics at least twice in the past 5 years in conversations that had nothing to do with physics. The IYI likes to use buzzwords from philosophy of science when discussing unrelated phenomena. He goes two or three levels too theoretical for a given problem. To conclude, the intellectual yet idiot knows at any given point in time what his words or actions are doing to his reputation. But a much easier marker. He doesn't even deadlift. Also, the IYI thinks this criticism of IYIs means everybody is an idiot, not realizing that their group represents, as we said, a tiny minority. But they don't like their sense of entitlement to be challenged, and although they treat the rest of humans as inferiors, they don't like it when the water hose is turned to the opposite direction, what the French call arrosat arrosé. For instance, the economist and psychalofaster Richard Thaler, partner of the dangerous GMO advocate Ubernudger Cass Sunstein, interpreted this piece as saying that there are not many non-idiots not called Taleb, not realizing that people like him are less than 1% or even less than 1/10 of 1% of the population. Postscript. From the reactions to this chapter, which was posted before the presidential elections of 2016, I discovered that the typical IYI has difficulty, when reading, in differentiating between the satirical and the literal. Next, we stop the satirical and return to the main book with the so misunderstood topic of economic inequality by IYIs. Chapter 7. Inequality and Skin in the Game. The Static and the Dynamic. How to Go Bankrupt and Be Loved by the Many. Piketty's Equals. Inequality versus Inequality. There is inequality and inequality. The first is the inequality people tolerate, such as one's understanding compared to that of people deemed heroes, say Einstein, Michelangelo, or the recluse mathematician Grisha Perelman, in comparison to whom one has no difficulty acknowledging a large surplus. This applies to entrepreneurs, artists, soldiers, heroes, the singer Bob Dylan, Socrates, the current local celebrity chef, some Roman emperor of good repute, say Marcus Aurelius. In short, those for whom one can naturally be a fan. You may like to imitate them, you may aspire to be like them, but you don't resent them. The second is the inequality people find intolerable because the subject appears to be just a person like you, except that he has been playing the system and getting himself into rent-seeking, acquiring privileges that are not warranted. And although he has something you would not mind having, which may include his Russian girlfriend, you cannot possibly become a fan. The latter category includes bankers, bureaucrats who get rich, former senators shilling for the evil firm Monsanto, clean-shaven chief executives who wear ties, and talking heads on television making outsized bonuses. You don't just envy them. You take umbrage at their fame, and the sight of their expensive or even semi-expensive car triggers some feeling of bitterness. They make you feel smaller. It came to my notice that in countries with high rent-seeking, wealth is seen as something zero-sum. You take from Peter to give to Paul. On the other hand, in places with low rent-seeking, say the United States before the Obama administration, wealth is seen as a positive-sum game, benefiting everybody. There may be something dissonant in the spectacle of a rich slave. The author Joan C. Williams, in an insightful article, explains that the American working class is impressed by the rich as role models, something people in the media, who communicate with one another but rarely with subjects in the real world, don't realize as they impart normative ideas to people. This is how they should think. Michel Lamont, the author of The Dignity of Working Men, cited by Williams, did a systematic interview of blue-collar Americans and found a resentment of high-paid professionals, but unexpectedly, not of the rich. It is safe to say that the American public, actually all publics, despises people who make a lot of money on a salary, or rather, salarymen who make a lot of money. This is indeed generalized to other countries. A few years ago, the Swiss, of all people, ran a referendum for a law capping salaries of managers to a set multiple of the lowest wage. The law didn't pass, but the fact that they thought in these terms is rather significant. For the same Swiss hold rich entrepreneurs and people who have derived their celebrity by other means in some respect. Further, in countries where wealth comes from rent-seeking, political patronage, or regulatory capture, which, I remind the reader, is how the powerful and the insiders use regulation to scam the public, or red tape to slow down competition, wealth is seen as zero-sum. Complex regulations allow former government employees to find jobs helping firms navigate the regulations they themselves created. What Peter gets is extracted from Paul. Someone getting rich is doing so at other people's expense. In countries such as the U.S., where wealth can come from destruction, people can easily see that someone getting rich is not taking dollars from your pocket. Odds are he is even putting some in yours. On the other hand, inequality, by definition, is zero-sum. In this chapter, I will propose that what people resent, or should resent, is the person at the top who has no skin in the game. That is, because he doesn't bear his allotted risk, he is immune to the possibility of falling from his pedestal, exiting his income or wealth bracket, and waiting in line outside the soup kitchen. Again, on that account, the detractors of Donald Trump, when he was still a candidate, not only misunderstood the value of scars as risk signaling, but they also failed to realize that by advertising his episode of bankruptcy and his personal losses of close to $1 billion, he removed the resentment, the second type of inequality, people may have had toward him. There is something respectable in losing $1 billion, provided it is your own money. In addition, someone without skin in the game, say a corporate executive with upside and no financial downside, the type to speak clearly in meetings, is paid according to some metrics that do not necessarily reflect the health of his company. These he can manipulate, hide risks, get the bonus, then retire, or go do the same thing in another company, and blame his successor for subsequent results. We will also, in the process, redefine inequality and put the notion on more rigorous grounds. But we first need to introduce the difference between two types of approaches, the static and the dynamic, as skin in the game can transform one type of inequality into another. Take also the two following remarks. True equality is equality in probability, and skin in the game prevents systems from rotting. The static and the dynamic. Visibly, a problem with economists, particularly those who never took risk, is that they have mental difficulties with things that move and are unable to consider that things that move have different attributes from things that don't. That's the reason complexity theory and fat tails, which we will explain a few pages down, are foreign to most of them. They also have severe difficulties with the mathematical and conceptual intuitions required for deeper probability theory. Blindness to ergodicity, which we will begin to define a few paragraphs down, is indeed, in my opinion, the best marker separating a genuine scholar who understands something about the world from an academic hack who partakes of ritualistic paper writing. A few definitions. Static inequality is a snapshot view of inequality. It does not reflect what will happen to you in the course of your life. Consider that about 10% of Americans will spend at least a year in the top 1%, and more than half of all Americans will spend a year in the top 10%. 39% of Americans will spend a year in the top 5% of the income distribution, 56% will find themselves in the top 10%, and 73% will spend a year in the top 20%. This is visibly not the same for the more static but nominally more equal Europe. For instance, only 10% of the wealthiest 500 American people or dynasties were so 30 years ago. More than 60% on the French list are heirs, and a third of the richest Europeans were the richest centuries ago. In Florence, it was just revealed that things are even worse. The same handful of families have kept the wealth for five centuries. Dynamic, ergodic inequality takes into account the entire future and past life. You do not create dynamic equality just by raising the level of those at the bottom, but rather by making the rich rotate, or by forcing people to incur the possibility of creating an opening. The way to make society more equal is by forcing, through skin in the game, the rich to be subjected to the risk of exiting from the 1%. Or, more mathematically, dynamic equality assumes Markov chain with no absorbing states. Our condition here is stronger than mere income mobility. Mobility means that someone can become rich. The no-absorbing barrier condition means that someone who is rich should never be certain to stay rich. Now, even more mathematically, dynamic equality is what restores ergodicity, making time and ensemble probabilities substitutable. Let me explain ergodicity, something that we said is foreign to the intelligentsia. Chapter 19 at the back of the book goes into the details. It cancels most crucial psychological experiments related to probability and rationality. The intuition for now is as follows. Take a cross-sectional picture of the U.S. population. You have, say, a minority of millionaires in the 1%, some overweight, some tall, some humorous. You also have a high majority of people in the lower middle class, yoga instructors, baking experts, gardening consultants, spreadsheet theoreticians, dancing advisors, and piano repair persons, plus, of course, the Spanish grammar specialist. Take the percentages of each income or wealth bracket. Note that the inequality of income is typically flatter than that of wealth. Perfect ergodicity means that each one of us, should he live forever, would spend a proportion of time in the economic conditions of the entire cross-section. Out of, say, a century, an average of 60 years in the lower middle class, 10 years in the upper middle class, 20 years in the blue-collar class, and perhaps one single year in the 1%. A technical comment for nitpickers. What we can call here imperfect ergodicity means that each one of us has long-term ergodic probabilities that have some variation among individuals. Your probability of ending in the 1% may be higher than mine. Nevertheless, no state will have a probability of 0 for me, and no state will have a transition probability of 1 for you. Another comment for nitpickers. Rawls's veil, discussed in Fooled by Randomness, assumes that a fair society is the one which you would select if there were some type of a lottery. Here we go further and discuss a dynamic structure, in other words, how such a society would move, as it obviously will not be static. The exact opposite of perfect ergodicity is an absorbing state. The term absorption is derived from particles that, when they hit an obstacle, get absorbed or stick to it. An absorbing barrier is like a trap. Once in, you can't get out, good or bad. A person gets rich by some process, then, having arrived, he stays rich. And if someone enters the lower middle class, from above, he will never have the chance to exit from it and become rich, should he want to, of course. Hence, will be justified to resent the rich. You will notice that where the state is large, people at the top tend to have little downward mobility. In such places as France, the state is chummy with large corporations and protects their executives and shareholders from experiencing such descent. It even encourages their ascent. And no downside for some means no upside for the rest. Piquetism and the revolt of the Mandarin class. This section is technical and can be skipped by those who aren't particularly impressed with economists. There is a class often called the Mandarins, after the fictionalized memoirs of the French author Simone de Beauvoir, named after the scholars of the Ming Dynasty. The High Chinese language is also called Mandarin. I have always been aware of their existence, but a salient and pernicious attribute came to me while observing the reactions of its members to the works of the French economist Thomas Piketty. Piketty followed Karl Marx by writing an ambitious book on capital. A friend gave me the book as a gift when it was still in French, and unknown outside France, because I find it commendable that people publish their original non-mathematical work in social science in book format. The book, Capital in the 21st Century, makes aggressive claims about the alarming rise of inequality, adding to it a theory of why capital tends to command too much return in relation to labor and how the absence of redistribution and dispossession might make the world collapse. Piketty's theory about the increase in the return of capital in relation to labor is patently wrong, as anyone who has witnessed the rise of what is called the knowledge economy, or anyone who has had investments in general, knows. Clearly, when you say that inequality changes from year one to year two, you need to show that those who are at the top are the same people, something Piketty doesn't do. Remember that he is an economist and has trouble with things that move. But the problem doesn't stop there. Soon I discovered that, aside from deriving conclusions from static measures of inequality, the methods he used were flawed. Piketty's tools did not match what he purported to show about the rise in inequality. There was no mathematical rigor. I soon wrote two articles, one in collaboration with Raphael Doady, another with Andrea Fontanari and Pasquale Cirillo, published in Physica A, Statistical Mechanics and Applications, about the measure of inequality that consists in taking the ownership of, say, the top 1% and monitoring its variations. The flaw is that if you take the inequality thus measured in Europe as a whole, you will find it is higher than the average inequality across component countries. The bias increases in severity with processes that deliver a high degree of inequality. All in all, the papers had enough theorems and proofs to make them about as ironclad a piece of work as one can have in science. Although it was not necessary, I insisted on putting the results in theorem form because someone cannot contest a formally proved theorem without putting in question his own understanding of mathematics. The reason these errors were not known was because economists who work with inequality were not familiar with inequality. Inequality is the disproportion of the role of the tail. Rich people were in the tails of the distribution. The type of distributions, called fat tails, associated with it made the analyses more delicate, far more delicate, and it had become my mathematical specialty. In Mediocristan, changes over time are the result of the collective contributions of the center, the middle. In Extremistan, these changes come from the tails. Sorry if you don't like it, but that is purely mathematical. The more inequality in the system, the more the winner-take-all effect, the more we depart from the methods of thin-tailed Mediocristan, see glossary, in which economists were trained. The wealth process is dominated by winner-take-all effects. Any form of control of the wealth process, typically instigated by bureaucrats, tends to lock people with privileges in their state of entitlement. So the solution is to allow the system to destroy the strong, something that works best in the United States. But there was something far, far more severe than a scholar being wrong. The problem is never the problem. It is how people handle it. What was worse than Piketty's flaws was the discovery of how that Mandarin class operates. They got so prematurely excited by the evidence of the rise in inequality that their reactions were like fake news. Actually, they were fake news. Economists got so carried away. They praised Piketty for his erudition because he discussed Balzac and Jane Austen, the equivalent to hailing as a weightlifter someone spotted carrying a briefcase across Terminal B. And they completely ignored my results. And when they didn't, it was to declare that I was arrogant. Recall the strategy of using formal mathematics as a way to make it impossible to say you are wrong, which is a form of scientific compliment. Even Paul Krugman, a currently famous economist and public intellectual, wrote, "If you think you found an obvious hole, empirical or logical, in Piketty, you're very probably wrong. He's done his homework." When I met him in person and pointed out the flaw to him, he evaded it, not necessarily out of malice, but most likely because probability and combinatorics eluded him, by his own admission. Now consider that the likes of Krugman and Piketty have no downside in their existence. Lowering inequality brings them up in the ladder of life. Unless the university system or the French state goes bust, they will continue receiving their paychecks. The fellow you just saw in the steak restaurant dripping with gold chains is exposed to the risk of the soup kitchen, not them. Just as those who live by the sword die by the sword, those who earn their living taking risks will lose their livelihood taking risks. If the process is fat-tailed, extremistan, then wealth is generated at the top, which means increases in wealth lead to increases of measured inequality. Within populations, wealth creation is a series of small probability bets. So it is natural that the pool of wealth, measured in years of spending, as Piketty does, increases with wealth. Consider 100 people in an 80-20 world. The additional wealth should come from one person, with the remaining bottom 50 contributing nothing. It is not a zero-sum gain. Eliminate that person, and there will be almost no wealth increases. In fact, the rest are already benefiting from the contribution of the minority. We've made a big deal out of Piketty here because the widespread enthusiasm for his book was representative of the behavior of that class of people who love to theorize and engage in false solidarity with the oppressed while consolidating their privileges. Cobbler envies cobbler. The reason regular people are not as acrimonious as the intellectuals and bureaucrats is because envy does not travel long distance or cross many social classes. Envy does not originate with the impoverished, concerned with the betterment of their condition, but with the clerical class. Simply, it looks like it was the university professors who have arrived and people who have permanent stability of income in the form of tenure, governmental or academic, who bought heavily into Piketty's argument. From conversations, I became convinced that people who counterfactual upwards, i.e. compare themselves to those richer, want to actively dispossess the rich. As with all communist movements, it is often the bourgeois or clerical classes who are the early adopters of revolutionary theories. So class envy doesn't originate from a truck driver in South Alabama, but from a New York or Washington, D.C. Ivy League educated IYI, say Paul Krugman or Joseph Stiglitz, with a sense of entitlement, upset some less smart persons are much richer. Aristotle, in his Rhetoric, postulated that envy is something you are more likely to encounter in your own kin. Lower classes are more likely to experience envy toward their cousins or the middle class than toward the very rich. And the expression, "nobody is a prophet in his own land," making envy a geographical thing, mistakenly thought to originate with Jesus, originates from that passage in the Rhetoric. Aristotle himself was building on Hesiod, "cobbler envies cobbler, carpenter envies carpenter." Later, Jean de La Bruyère wrote that jealousy is to be found within the same art, talent, and condition. So I doubt Piketty bothered to ask blue-collar Frenchmen what they want, as Michel Lamont did, as we saw earlier in the chapter. I am certain that they would ask for better beer, a new dishwasher, or faster trains for their commute, not to bring down some rich businessman invisible to them. But, again, people can frame questions and portray enrichment as theft, as was done before the French Revolution, in which case the blue-collar class would ask, once again, for heads to roll. What happened with the UK Parliament expenses scandal? MPs were giving themselves TVs and dishwashers, which the public could easily imagine, and revolted against. One MP said, "It's not like I took 1 million in bonds." The public understands TVs, not bonds. Inequality, wealth, and vertical socialization. If intellectuals are overly worried about inequality, it is because they tend to view themselves in hierarchical terms, and thus think that others do too. Furthermore, as if by pathology, discussions in competitive universities are all about hierarchy. Most people in the real world don't obsess over it. There is a technical argument that, if one looks at the issue dynamically, not statically, a wealth tax favors the salary person over the entrepreneur. In the more rural past, envy was rather controlled. Wealthy people were not as exposed to other persons of their class. They didn't have the pressure to keep up with other wealthy persons and compete with them. The wealthy stayed within their region, surrounded by people who depended on them, say, a lord on his property. Except for the occasional season in the cities, their social life was quite vertical. Their children played with the children of the servants. It was in mercantile urban environments that socializing within social classes took place. And over time, with industrialization, the rich started moving to cities or suburbs, surrounded by other people of similar, but not completely similar, condition. Hence, they needed to keep up with each other, racing on a treadmill. For a rich person isolated from vertical socializing with the poor becomes something entirely theoretical, a textbook reference. As I mentioned in the past chapter, I have yet to see a Bien Pensant Cambridge Don hanging out with Pakistani cab drivers or lifting weights with Cockney speakers. The intelligentsia, therefore, feels entitled to deal with the poor as a construct, one they created. Thus, they become convinced that they know what is best for them. Empathy and homophily. Recall the scaling problem, the idea that people's ethical rules are not universal. They vary according to whether someone is Swiss, that is, an outsider, or not. The same applies to empathy, the reverse of envy. You can see that people feel more for those of their class. Traditionally, the upper class engaged in rescuing those from ruined families by making them stewards, or dames de compagnie. Such in-group protection has a self-insurance attribute, something that can only work for a limited number of people and can't be universalized. You take care of my progeny if they are ruined, I will take care of yours. Data Schmata. Another lesson from Piketty's ambitious volume. It was loaded with charts and tables. There is a lesson here. What we learn from professionals in the real world is that data is not necessarily rigor. One reason I, as a probability professional, left data out of the black swan, except for illustrative purposes, is that it seems to me that people flood their stories with numbers and graphs in the absence of solid or logical arguments. Further, people mistake empiricism for a flood of data. Just a little bit of significant data is needed when one is right, particularly when it is disconfirmatory empiricism or counterexamples. Only one data point, a single extreme deviation, is sufficient to show that black swans exist. Traders, when they make profits, have short communications. When they lose, they drown you in details, theories, and charts. Probability, statistics, and data science are principally logic fed by observations and absence of observations. For many environments, the relevant data points are those in the extremes. These are rare by definition, and it suffices to focus on those few but big to get an idea of the story. If you want to show that a person has more than, say, $10 million, all you need is to show the $50 million in his brokerage account, not in addition. List every piece of furniture in his house, including the $500 painting in his study and the silver spoons in the pantry. So I've discovered, with experience, that when you buy a thick book with tons of graphs and tables used to prove a point, you should be suspicious. It means something didn't distill right. But for the general public and those untrained in statistics, such tables appear convincing. Another way to substitute the true with the complicated. For instance, the science journalist Steven Pinker played that trick with his book The Better Angels of Our Nature, which claims a decline of violence in modern human history, and attributes this to modern institutions. My collaborator Pasquale Cirillo and I, when we put his data under scrutiny, found out that either he didn't understand his own numbers, actually he didn't, or he had a story in mind and kept adding charts, not realizing that statistics isn't about data, but distillation, rigor, and avoiding being fooled by randomness. But no matter. The general public and his state-worshipping IYI colleagues found it impressive, for a while. Ethics of Civil Service. Let us finish this discussion with an unfairness that is worse than inequality. The sore sight of back-office, non-risk-takers getting rich from public service. When, on leaving office, Barack Obama accepted a sum of more than $40 million to write his memoirs, many people were outraged. His supporters, statists who were defending him, on the other hand, were critical of the rich entrepreneurs hired by the subsequent administration. Money is greed for them. But those who did not earn the money via commerce were illogically exempt. I had a rough time explaining that having rich people in a public office is very different from having public people become rich. Again, it is the dynamics, the sequence, that matters. Rich people in public office have shown some evidence of lack of total incompetence. Success may come from randomness, of course, but we at least have a hint of some skill in the real world, some evidence that the person has dealt with reality. This is, of course, conditional on the person having had skin in the game. And it is better if the person felt a blow-up, has experienced at least once the loss of part of his or her fortune and the angst associated with it. As usual, there is a mix of the ethical and the effective here. It is downright unethical to use public office for enrichment. A good rule for society is to oblige those who start in public office to pledge never subsequently to earn from the private sector more than a set amount. The rest should go to the taxpayer. This will ensure sincerity in literally service, where employees are supposedly underpaid because of their emotional reward from serving society. It would prove that they are not in the public sector as an investment strategy. You do not become a Jesuit priest because it may help you get hired by Goldman Sachs later, after your eventual defrocking, given the erudition and the masterly control of casuistry generally associated with the Society of Jesus. Currently, most civil servants tend to stay in civil service, except for those in delicate areas that industry controls, the agro-alimentary segment, finance, aerospace, anything related to Saudi Arabia. A civil servant can make rules that are friendly to an industry such as banking, and then go off to J.P. Morgan and recoup a multiple of the difference between his or her current salary and the market rate. Regulators, you may recall, have an incentive to make rules as complex as possible so their expertise can later be hired at a higher price. So there is an implicit bribe in civil service. You act as a servant to an industry, say Monsanto, and they take care of you later on. They do not do it out of a sense of honor. Simply, it is necessary to keep the system going and encourage the next guy to play by these rules. The IYI cum croniest former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, with whom I share the Calabrese barber of the prologue, was overtly rewarded by the industry he helped bail out. He helped bankers get bailouts, let them pay themselves from the largest bonus pool in history after the crisis in 2010, that is, using taxpayer money, and then got a multi-million dollar job at a financial institution as his reward for good behavior. Next. There is a vicious domain dependence of expertise. The electrician, dentist, scholar of Portuguese irregular verbs, assistant colonoscopist, London cabbie, and algebraic geometer are experts, plus or minus some local variations, while the journalist, State Department bureaucrat, clinical psychologist, management theorist, publishing executive, and macroeconomist are not. This allows us to answer the questions, who is the real expert? Who decides who is and who is not an expert? Where is the meta-expert? Time is the expert, or rather the temperamental and ruthless Lindy, as we see in the next chapter. Chapter 8. An Expert Called Lindy. She is the one and only expert. Don't eat their cheesecake. Meta-experts judged by meta-meta-experts. Prostitutes, non-prostitutes, and amateurs. Lindy is a deli in New York, now a tourist trap, that proudly claims to be famous for its cheesecake, but in fact has been known for 50 or so years by physicists and mathematicians thanks to the heuristic that developed there. Actors who hung out there, gossiping about other actors, discovered that Broadway shows that lasted for, say, 100 days, had a future life expectancy of 100 more. For those that lasted 200 days, 200 more. The heuristic became known as the Lindy effect. Let me warn the reader. While the Lindy effect is one of the most useful, robust, and universal heuristics I know, Lindy's cheesecake is much less distinguished. Odds are the deli will not survive by the Lindy effect. There had been a bevy of mathematical models that sort of fit the story, though not really, until A, yours truly, figured out that the Lindy effect can best be understood using the theory of fragility and antifragility, and B, the mathematician Ido Eliezer formalized its probabilistic structure. Actually, the theory of fragility directly leads to the Lindy effect. Simply, my collaborators and I managed to define fragility as sensitivity to disorder. The porcelain owl sitting in front of me on the writing desk as I am writing these lines wants tranquility. It dislikes shocks, disorder, variations, earthquakes, mishandling by dust-phobic cleaning service operators, travel in a suitcase transiting through Terminal 5 in Heathrow, and shelling by Saudi Barbaria-sponsored Islamist militias. Clearly, it has no upside from random events and, more generally, disorder. More technically, being fragile, it necessarily has a non-linear reaction to stressors. Up until its breaking point, shocks of larger intensity affected disproportionately more than smaller ones. Now, crucially, time is equivalent to disorder, and resistance to the ravages of time, that is, what we gloriously call survival, is the ability to handle disorder. That which is fragile has an asymmetric response to volatility and other stressors, that is, will experience more harm than benefit from it. In probability, volatility and time are the same. The idea of fragility helped put some rigor around the notion that the only effective judge of things is time. By things, we mean ideas, people, intellectual productions, car models, scientific theories, books, etc. You can't fool Lindy. Books of the type written by the current hotshot op-ed writer at the New York Times may get some hype at publication time, manufactured or spontaneous, but their 5-year survival rate is generally less than that of pancreatic cancer. Who is the real expert? Effectively, Lindy answers the age-old meta questions, who will judge the expert, who will guard the guard? Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who will judge the judges? Well, survival will. For time operates through skin in the game. Things that have survived are hinting to us ex post that they have some robustness, conditional on their being exposed to harm. For without skin in the game, via exposure to reality, the mechanism of fragility is disrupted. Things may survive for no reason for a while, at some scale, then ultimately collapse, causing a lot of collateral harm. A few more details. For those interested in the intricacies, the Lindy effect has been covered at length in Antifragile. There are two ways things handle time. First, there is aging and perishability. Things die because they have a biological clock, what we call senescence. Second, there is hazard, the rate of accidents. What we witness in physical life is the combination of the two. When you are old and fragile, you don't handle accidents very well.